Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and in the next two half-hour segments, we're going to introduce a number of stories and update a few as well. We're going to be traveling around the world. We're going to be dealing, as always, with political reaction and fascism and imperialism where it exists around the world. And we're going to begin with all of those things in Germany. There are a number of very troubled noises coming out of Germany these days. And one of those is the noise that's being made about the European economy, the European economy, but the German economy in particular. The German economy is not doing well, and that is producing a number of strains in Germany. And in turn, Germany has been making a lot of noises at people in other parts of Europe and in the world. Indeed, the center-left government, quote, center-left government, unquote, currently in power in Germany, is beginning to sound more than a little like its most reactionary predecessors. We're going to begin with the Financial Times of London of Wednesday, February 24th of 1999. This is an article by Tony Barber, or an op-ed column by Tony Barber. It is on the comment and analysis page, and its headline, Germany's Blame Game. It's subtitled, Europe's largest economy is trying to find a scapegoat for its shrinking GDP rather than agreeing on compromises that could lead to solutions, writes Tony Barber. Europe's largest economy is in deep trouble. If you didn't know it from last Friday's news that the German economy shrank in the final 3 months of 1998, you would soon learn it from the gush of bickering about whose fault it is. Germany's ruling Social Democrats blame the independent European Central Bank for not stimulating growth in the Eurozone by means of a cut in interest rates. The ECB and its supporters in the Bundesbank criticize the government for failing to introduce labor market reforms and for wavering in its commitment to fiscal discipline. Employers pour scorn on the government's tax policies and denounce trade unions for insisting on unaffordable wage increases. Trade unionists attack industrialists for not believing in government-sponsored talks on job creation and for not wanting to share record profits with their workforces. Skipping down, this outbreak of claim and counterclaim, accusation and counteraccusation bears witness to the frustration felt by those charged with the task of reviving what was once the locomotive of Europe. The 0.4% quarter-on-quarter contraction in gross domestic product coincided with the publication of a closely watched business climate index that showed a drop for the eighth successive month in the confidence of German businessmen. Worse may be yet to come. And skipping down, some of the angry noises have been coming from Oscar Lafontaine, who has been inclined to blame the European Central Bank, and despite prior agreement, including by people in Germany and people associated with the Bundesbank, that interest rates should remain relatively stable in order to assure of a strong euro. Mr. Lafontaine has been pressuring the ECB to cut rates. That's the European Central Bank. This despite the fact that the euro was not supposed to be a politicized currency. Skipping down, Mr. Lafontaine and his finance ministry advisors think they have the answer. It lies in an ECB rate cut, a euro that is stable but not too strong, a boost to consumer demand from tax reforms, and private sector wage increases and possibly even an increase in government spending. Only such measures, they say, are adequate to cope with the shock inflicted by the global turmoil of the past 20 months. And as Mr. Lafontaine put it in a report this month to the 10 other Eurozone member states, quote, monetary policy is certainly the preferred instrument to respond to this shock. If it is not used, fiscal measures cannot be ruled out because the option of doing nothing could turn out to be extremely expensive. And skipping down yet again, matters are no more encouraging on the labor front. Industrialists had scarcely signed their agreement with IG Metall, by the way, that's a metal workers union, before they were lamenting the consequences. Quote, everything that has happened during the wage talks has done nothing to create jobs but merely destroyed them, unquote, said Hans Olaf Henkel, head of the Federation of German Industry. And skipping down yet again, here lies one clue to the tensions characterizing German society and the political arena. Germany's adjustment to the sharper competitive conditions thrown up by the globalization of markets and the euro's launch is compelling multinational companies, medium-sized businesses, trade unions, non-unionized labor, and other groups to defend their various interests. These differ rather more from each other now than they did in the 1950s and 1960s, the heyday of the former West Germany's Wirtschaftswunder, or economic miracle. And there are a number of pressures that are building in Germany. And again, Germany's been making a lot of noise towards people who are other EU members. It's been making a lot of noise in the direction of immigrants, as we will see. And one of the problems that is bedeviling and exacerbating the problems in Germany, or is bedeviling Germany and exacerbating the problem in Germany, is something not unlike one of the problems that has beset the U.S. economy over the last two decades, although the U.S. at this point is in a state of relative economic health. In fact, relatively speaking, it's doing quite well. Namely, despite the fact that German corporations are insisting that German workers are making too much and that German workers surrender benefits and wages in order to become competitive, rather than sinking money into job creation, German corporations have been moving out of Germany and indeed have been spending a lot of money buying up competition in foreign countries, the United States in particular, because the business climate in the United States is seen as more propitious. So a lot of German corporations have been purchasing tasty-looking American corporations rather than tending the labor and industrial front in their own country. Another core of the major German corporations that has begun doing this is contemplating doing this, I should say, is Allianz, Europe's largest insurer. This once again comes from the Financial Times of London, this from Thursday, February 25th of 1999. This is by Tony Barber in Frankfurt. It's headlined, Allianz may move key operations out of Germany. Allianz, Europe's largest insurer, yesterday threatened to move key business operations out of Germany if the Social Democrat-led government presses ahead with tax reforms targeting insurance companies. Skipping down, Allianz's threat is the latest sign of discontent in the German business community with the economic policies pursued by the red-green coalition government in Bonn elected last September. Employers have also criticized Chancellor Gerhard Schroeder's Alliance for Jobs, unquote, between employers, trade unions, and government as interventionist. And it remains to be seen if this pattern continues. Certainly that is not going to help things in Germany, and it'll be interesting to see exactly what result comes of the social turmoil that is beginning to become evident in Germany as various elements rub up against one another. But an increased chauvinism and aggression, whether diplomatic or ultimately military abroad, and increased repression and increased xenophobia at home, perhaps ultimately resulting in the complete reemergence of German fascism. German fascism has been reemerging ever since the reunification in 1990, and actually really since the Berlin Wall fell, and its complete triumph in Germany above board, as opposed to the underground Reich that I've spoken about, is not an outcome that I would rule out if things continue to go to disintegrate there, and indeed if there is a global economic collapse. Again, there is a lot of pressure being exerted by Germany on other members of the EU, and some of that pressure is being directed at the European Central Bank. Despite the agreement that the euro and the European Central Bank would be beyond politicization, in fact, although Germany was a big endorser of that as the euro was taking shape or as the European Monetary Union was taking shape, now Germany is leading the charge to have a politicized European Central Bank and a politicized euro. Once again, we're going to turn to the Financial Times of London. And by the way, its website is www.ft.com. That's www.ft.com. The Financial Times of London is arguably the best economic paper in the world. Much better, certainly, for economic news than the Wall Street Journal. That's a little more, in my opinion, than the Raiderettes for the mutual fund industry. But the Financial Times of London of Monday, February 22nd of 1999, had the following story by Wolfgang Munchau and Alan Beatty and Robert Choate in Bonn. It's headlined, German Bank Chief Fears Effective Fall in Euro Exchange Rate. Hans Tietmeyer, president of the Bundesbank, has hinted that the European Central Bank would be worried if the euro fell further against the dollar as the ECB came under further pressure to boost European growth. Speaking after a meeting of Group of Seven finance ministers and central bankers on Saturday, he said, quote, the euro is certainly not overvalued. What matters is that the euro earns a position of confidence in the long run. Mr. Tietmeyer's comments came after Oskar Lafontaine, German finance minister, said the euro was neither strong nor weak. At present, the euro closed at $1.1096 last week, 5% weaker than its launch in January. And again, the pressure that is being exerted by Oscar Lafontaine has alarmed a number of people, and Hans Tietmeyer at this point, the head of the Bundesbank, is worried, basically, that if the euro falls further against the dollar, it is going to create even a greater conflict between the pressure on the part of LaFontaine to lower interest rates and the need to maintain those interest rates high in order to shore up the euro status against the dollar. The European Monetary Union and the formation of the euro was a calculated risk from the beginning. The European Monetary Union is the realization of a long-standing plan for German world domination that formulated by pan-German theoretician Friedrich Liest in the 1840s, in which he advocated a European economic and trade union under German domination as a vehicle for unseating Great Britain as the dominant power on Earth. That realization has now been concretized with the European Monetary Union. The only major difference is that the United States is the major power on Earth to be unseated, not the United Kingdom. As to whether the euro is strong or weak, either way, it's likely to damage the U.S. and global economy. The conflict between the cost of doing business in Europe and interest rates and the depressed European economy, the need to stimulate that economy, and the need to keep interest rates relatively high in order to attract investment capital is one of the divisions that had long been evident with regard to the euro, and is one of the conflicts that had been envisioned by many, the conflict between the need for budgetary restraint on the part of the member nations and also the need to basically create money in order to create jobs. This is the central conflict that is now resulting in Hans Tietmeyer hinting that he was worried if the euro continued to fall against the dollar, translation in all likelihood, interest rates should stay high. And Oscar Lafontaine, the German finance minister, who is hinting that there should be a lowering of rates by the ECB. This is the political euro or political ECB that many of the saner heads in Europe had been saying would not happen, and now it's beginning to happen. There was also a lot of conflict now between Germany and other countries in the EU because Germany wants to slash the amount of money that it has to contribute to other countries in the European Union, in particular France and the EU rebate won by the United Kingdom. And this is leading to increased friction between Germany and other countries in the EU. We spoke about this, by the way, in a half-hour segment called Update on Germany, done earlier in February of 1999. Once again, we're going to turn to the Financial Times of London, this from Wednesday, February 24th of 1999. This is by Ralph Atkins in Bonn and Michael Smith in Brussels. It's headlined, Bonn Warns Over EU Finance Reforms. And this article reads in part, Germany yesterday warned that failure to agree to wide-ranging reforms of European Union finances next month could trigger a crisis in the EU and a damaging fall in the euro. Government officials said yesterday that a collapse of the talks at the Berlin EU summit in late March would convince financial markets that, quote, the Europeans are not in a position to pull their act together, unquote. EU government leaders meet on Friday for an informal summit in Bonn, which the officials describe as a dramatic intermediate step to sound out possible solutions before the decisive Berlin summit. The tone of the comments reflected the difficulties faced by Germany, holder of the EU's rotating presidency, in reaching a deal on an Agenda 2000, unquote, blueprint to change budget finances, regional aid, and farm policy. Farm ministers are meeting in Brussels all week to try to agree to a deal on agricultural reform, but widespread differences remain. Jean Glavany, French farm minister, said his country had, quote, deep divisions with Germany, particularly over funding. That finance minister's name, or the agricultural minister's name, is Glavany. Skipping down again, Germany also wants a debate on the EU rebate won by the United Kingdom in the early 1980s. That EU rebate to some of the poorer areas of the United Kingdom has been spurring British economic growth, and some of that money has been coming, of course, from Germany, the richest and most powerful country in the European Union, and that has led Germany to make some very angry noises in the direction of some of its EU neighbors. Again, domestic friction in Germany between various elements, including corporations and labor, and major corporations either moving out or threatening to move out of Germany and spending capital on buying foreign investments, foreign corporations, largely American, rather than investing in job creation at home, and also a lot of angry noise being made by Germany toward its EU partners. This does not bode well for the future. Also, a lot of angry noise is being made by the current government and people involved in it toward the large number of immigrants in Germany. Indeed, in addition to the overtly fascist elements in Germany and the conservative CDU-CSU, the new center-left government, quote-unquote, in Germany is also pointing to, quote, foreigners, unquote, and, quote, immigrants, unquote, as largely the cause of Germany's problems. This is very similar to the reactionary and xenophobic tone, scapegoating, quote, immigrants, unquote, that one is seeing around the world, including and especially here in the United States. The French right, the American right, the Austrian right, the German right, and reactionary and fascist elements around the world have been making a lot of noises like this, and a fair amount of those noises have been coming from ostensibly left or center-left governments in Europe, including and especially Germany. The San Francisco Chronicle of Monday, February 22nd of 1999, carried a couple of very good stories by Frank Viviano. Those of you who are not aware of the work that Viviano has done, last name V-I-V-I-A-N-O, he's doing as good a body of work as anyone in the mainstream press, and better than the overwhelming majority, considerably better than most people in the progressive media as well. He's been doing some superb reporting, in particular on Eurofascism and its similarities to American reaction, although he has declined from labeling American reaction fascist. He has explicitly and at great length compared the policies of many of the fascist, the policies and rhetoric of many of the fascist powers of Europe. Fascist parties of Europe, excuse me, with the politics and rhetoric of Newt Gingrich and the Republican right in the United States. Again, from the Chronicle of 2/22/99, an article by Frank Viviano headlined, Law and Order Europolitics. Leftists compete with the right for hardline stance. Immigrant crime and mounting hysteria over it are not unique to northern Italy. In 1987, nearly 2 million refugees have poured into Germany, legally and illegally, part of an overall immigrant or foreign-born population of 10.7 million. As in Italy, a small but conspicuous number of them have drifted into the underworld. Quote, the Poles are especially active in organized car theft. Prostitution is dominated by the Russian mafia, and drug dealers come most often from Southeast Europe or Black Africa, unquote, Social Democratic Party Chief Gerhard Schroeder said in a 1997 speech prior to his election as German Chancellor. Quote, for those foreigners who violate our hospitality, there is only one, quote, solution, unquote, Schroeder said. Get out of Germany fast, unquote. His use of the term solution, I think, is ominous under the circumstances. Viviano here goes on to talk about similar rhetoric being exercised in other European countries, notably France. And skipping down more, he writes, more and more, law and order has been redefined as immigrant control, unquote, pushing the debate into dangerous terrain for centrist parties of any stripe, government critics warn. Politicians who play this card, quote, exploit the theme of fear, allowing people to believe that waves of foreigners are out to destroy the well-being of Germans, unquote, says Günter Verhugen, V-E-R-H-E-U-G-E-N, a social democratic expert on foreign affairs. And again, note the similarity between the reactionary immigrant and minority scapegoating tone of Gerhard Schroeder, the current prime minister of Germany, in particular scapegoating people of third world extraction, and some of the tone being sounded by the American right in recent decades, in particular the Republican Party of Newt Gingrich, scapegoating, quote, immigrants, unquote, and foreigners, unquote, and minorities as responsible for America's problems. Returning to the Viviano article once again, the dangers are greatest for the immigrants themselves. On February 14th, in what has become a grimly familiar drama in Germany, a 28-year-old Algerian immigrant severed an artery in his knee and bled to death while trying to escape a band of neo-Nazi bullies in the eastern state of Brandenburg. Again, illustrating the continuity between some of the rhetoric of the, quote, center-left, unquote, government in Germany and the overt policies of the fascist elements in that same country. The corporate role in the Third Reich, which was absolutely pivotal and central in the entire operation of the Third Reich, is once again a focus of the news in that there are now class action suits by former slave laborers who worked in some of the many corporations that helped to fund Nazism, not only German corporations, but some of their American counterparts that I've spoken about in so many programs, including Uncle Sam and the Swastika, the first two RFA shows, RFA number 10, and numerous For the Record segments. Those available from Spitfire. Research credit on the following goes to a listener who got this from Newsweek magazine of February 22nd of 1999. This is an article by Michael Hirsch, H-I-R-S-H, entitled Nazi-era Bill Finally Comes Due. Subtitled, Survivors of World War II Slave Labor Camps Are Filing Suits Against the Companies That Profited from Their Work. And the article reads in part as follows. Vaclav Kolodziejek, and I may be misspelling that, Kolodziejek, stands up, the smile frozen on his face, and pulls open his golf shirt. There on his chest, tattooed in bluish-purple, are the numbers 2254. They are slightly askew and off-center, as if the German who injected them was in a hurry. And in August 1940, when Kolodziejek arrived at Auschwitz, the Nazis were very much in a rush. Anxious to build their extermination factory, they yanked Kolodziejek and thousands of other Poles off the streets of Warsaw as conscripted labor. Kolodziejek, a 17-year-old Catholic with movie star looks, was on one of the first transports to Auschwitz. At the camp, he was beaten and terrorized. In 1942, Josef Mengele experimented on him, Kolodziejek says. Later, he nearly starved. He laughs about it now, except when discussing Mengele. Then his voice breaks because there's nothing else he can do. Kolodziejek spent the entire war in the camps. He worked for 3 horrific years at Auschwitz, eventually at a job carting rubber solvents for IG Farben, the German chemical giant. Later, he constructed planes for Messerschmitt at Mauthausen, a slave labor camp operated by the Nazis in Austria. His experience is a reminder of the strategy behind the Thousand-Year Reich's 12-year reign. Nazi Europe was run as a kind of pyramid scheme, conquer a country, then enslave its citizens to empower the machine to conquer more. Under fascism, the corporations that sustained this empire thrived on the low overhead provided by millions of slave laborers like Kolodziejek. Until now, most of these companies escaped history's notice. Only 3 firms, Farben, Krupp, and Flieck, were prosecuted after the war, and a few more paid a pittance in compensation. But in recent months, inspired by last year's $1.25 billion settlement between victims of the Holocaust and Swiss banks, lawyers have filed more than 24 class action lawsuits alleging that manufacturers, construction outfits, banks, and insurance companies in Europe, Britain, and the United States profited from the Holocaust. German companies, of course, have attracted most of the legal attention. Marquee names like Daimler-Benz, Volkswagen, Siemens, and dozens of others allegedly enslaved hundreds of thousands of Poles, Czechs, Russians, and Ukrainians to build camps and armaments and to work in plants. And skipping down once again. In addition, 6 U.S. companies with German subsidiaries that operated during the war, including GM and Ford, are being investigated by lawyers such as Washington attorney Michael Housefield, one of several who filed the Polish suit. And I would note that many of those corporations alluded to there are actually focal points of class action suits. I've spoken about the absolutely pivotal economic aid given by American corporations to the Third Reich and to Mussolini, again in numerous archive shows, including Uncle Sam and the Swastika, Uncle Sam and Il Duce, the aforementioned RFA shows, and numerous For the Record segments. That same topic is also the focal point of a couple of books that are available, or one of the focal points of a couple of books that are available at this time. One is The Secret War Against the Jews by John Loftus and Mark Ahrens. hard and soft cover editions by the St. Martin's Press. The other is The Splendid Blonde Beast by Christopher Simpson, subtitled Money, Law, and Genocide in the 20th Century. That's put out in soft cover by Common Courage Press, copyright 1995. And again, the pivotal support given by corporate America to the fascist powers of Europe is the focal point of a number of broadcasts that are available from Spitfire. Many of the same corporate interests that backed Hitler and Mussolini attempted to overthrow Franklin Roosevelt in 1934 and set up a fascist government in the United States. That's discussed in RFA number 10, dealing with the genesis and history of American fascism. And one of the only reasons that that coup attempt was frustrated was that the Marine Corps, the former Marine Corps Major General, who had been selected by the fascist conspirators to head the military coup, a two-time Congressional Medal of Honor winner named General Smedley Butler, B-U-T-L-E-R, chose to betray the coup. Butler was extremely conservative and was very critical of Roosevelt for that reason and for the fact that he was very popular among troops. The coup plotters, including some of the most powerful names in finance and industry, those grouped around the DuPont industrial interests and the House of Morgan in particular, they chose Smedley Butler to lead the coup. However, Smedley Butler pretended to go along, even though he was very conservative and very critical of Roosevelt. He was also opposed to fascism and a firm supporter of the Constitution. So Smedley Butler betrayed the coup plotters, and for that reason, the coup was frustrated. This is discussed in RFA program number 10, available from Spitfire. Smedley Butler, again, although very conservative, was also fiercely critical of the way U.S. corporations operated in the Third World, in Latin America in particular. It's one of the reasons why I have consistently over the years warned against ideologization. One should not judge someone by their ideology, but by their actions. Although very conservative, Smedley Butler has had one of the most incisive pieces of criticism of corporate America and their activities in Latin America that I have ever seen. In the past week, as I speak on February 28th of 1999, Smedley Butler's famous quote from Common Sense magazine appeared in two different periodicals. One was the San Francisco Chronicle of Friday, February 26th of 1999. This is an op-ed column by S. Brian Wilson, a longtime Bay Area peace activist and Vietnam veteran. This is entitled, Marines Seek to Use U.S. Cities to Train Invasion Forces, unquote. And skipping down, Wilson quotes Smedley Butler. General Smedley D. Butler, the most highly decorated Marine in U.S. history, concluded correctly after his retirement in 1931 that during his 33 years as a Marine operating on three continents, he served, quote, as a high-class muscle man for big business, for Wall Street, and the bankers, a gangster for capitalism, unquote. And oddly enough, in this very same week, the Napa Sentinel of Harry Martin had the same quote in a column by Lou Ferrario. That's F-E-R-R-A-R-I-O. This is from the Napa Sentinel of Friday, February 19th of 1999. This particular column by Lou Ferrario is entitled A Racketeer for Capitalism, and it quotes Smedley Butler. The entire quote again. I spent 33 years and 4 months in active service as a member of our country's most agile military force, the Marine Corps. I served in all commissioned ranks from a second lieutenant to major general. And during that period, I spent most of my time being a high-class muscle man for big business, for Wall Street, and for the bankers. In short, I was a racketeer for capitalism. Skipping down. Thus, I helped make Mexico, and especially Tampico, safe for American oil interests in 1914. I helped make Haiti and Cuba a decent place for the National City Bank boys to collect revenues in. I helped in the raping of half a dozen Central American republics for the benefit of Wall Street. I helped purify Nicaragua for the international banking house of Brown Brothers in 1909 through 12. I brought light to the Dominican Republic for American sugar interests in 1916. I helped make Honduras right, unquote, for American fruit companies in 1903, unquote. And we're going to take a look at Latin America, and in particular, Latin American fascism, Operation Condor, and its overlap with some elements of U.S. intelligence and U.S. foreign policy in our next half-hour segment. However, that concludes this half-hour. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.